Today we're beginning here on the top of Nun Aleph, Nun Aleph, 10 lines down. The Gemara here is discussing the argument that we saw yesterday between Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri and the Chachamim, whereby Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri says that with regards to a Nevelat Of Tahor, there's no necessity to have any Machshava in order to render it susceptible to Tumat Ochlim or to Tumat in general. He did that through a Kal V'Chomer, and the Chachamim rejected the Kal V'Chomer based on the fact that if you say by tuma chamura shekein eina yoredet dekach, tumar b'tuma kala shekein yoredet dekach. And we just had a discussion in the Gemara as to what that means. What does it mean, shekein yoredet dekach, sheina yoredet dekach? Rava made a suggestion that it is the difference between whether the tuma can create something that can also be mitame, something like it, or it cannot. Meaning by tuma chamura, the ava tuma of Nevela Tov Tahor can make something into a Rishon Tumah, like a human being, but that human being can't make another human being Tamei, because Rishon Tumah is the end of the line for Tumah in terms of Tumat Adam. Whereas by Tumat Ochlim, if you mix an Ochel Tamei, then Midrabanan, that Ochel can make another Ochel Tamei. So that would be the distinction that Rava suggests the Chachamim are using to disagree with Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri. Abaye rejected that and said, that can't be the case, because you only serve to enhance the Kal V'Chomer. You're just noting that there is a Tzad Chumra to Ochlin that doesn't exist by Tuma Chamura, and here you're trying to make a Kal V'Chomer that would even make it more reasonable or more impetus to make such a Kal V'Chomer. So then we had Rav Sheshit, who came along and said, the way to explain it is the following. When it comes to Tuma Chamura, it ain't a Tzricha Hechsher. Tuma Chamura in general doesn't require any Hechsher. That's not true by Tuma Kala, that does require Hechsher. And that's what the Gemara is up to now, Mitzricha Hechsher. Since when is it that Tuma Kala requires Hechsher? Ratnan. Don't we have a Mishnah that doesn't exist? Shlosha Dvarim, Nemru b'Nevelat Of Tahor. Three things are said about Nevelat Of Tahor. You never find such a Mishnah of Shlosha Dvarim. It might be a reference to the Mishnah that we saw yesterday, that we quoted from Masechet Tarot of Yud Gimel Dvarim Nemru b'Nevelat Of Tahor. So that actually might be that there's a Girsa problem here and it should read Shloshasar rather than Shlosha. But just like yesterday where we said there are 13 things said about Nevelat Of Tahor, and then we brought one of them down. Here we're bringing three of them down. It's not the complete list. But anyway, a little bit strange because there isn't such a Mishnah that Gemara is quoting as a Mishnah. But these are the three things relevant to our sugya that are true by Nevelat Of Tahor, which is Tricha Machshava. It requires active Machshava in order to make it into Tumat Ochlim. Veino Mitama Ela Bebeit Abliya. It also is only Mitama once it is eaten and it goes into the back of the throat. That's when it creates Tumah for the Adam and his Bigadim. Veino Tricha Hechsher. And it doesn't require Hechsher. So you see that even for Tumat Ochlim, there isn't this requirement of Hechsher. It says, Nehi De Hechsher Sheretz Lo Bayi. You're right, it doesn't need the extra of a sheretz. I mean, it doesn't need an outside tumah to make it tameh, because it has inherent tumah that is associated with it, because it has tumah chamura. Hechsher mayim bayit, but it still requires priming to accept tumah. The Gemara is suggesting at this point, when it comes to nevelat of tahor, even though a nevelat of tahor is only tameh when you swallow it, maga, masa, any interaction with it will not be tameh. The only time it's tameh is when you actually swallow it. That makes you tameh, makes your bigadim tameh. Nevertheless, there is a tzad of tumah to it associated with tumat ochlim, which is the tumah kala, which is what we're discussing now, the view of Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri versus the Chachamim as to whether you need machshava. And over here, the Mishnah makes a suggestion. First of all, you do require machshava. Ve'ena mitamah el beit abliyah. It only makes tumah in the back of the throat. Ve'ena tzricha hechsher. It doesn't require hechsher. Now, hechsher comes in two forms, as Rashi already noted in yesterday's daf. Hechsher means that it is primed to mikabel tumah. That is the requirement that a liquid wash or flow over the item before it can be mikabel tumah. And the other thing about extra tumah is the ability to become tameh. That means, do you need something else to make it tameh, or does it have inherent tumah? And over here, what the Gemara is suggesting is that it has inherent tumah because in the end it will become tameh when you swallow it. Therefore, there's some sort of inherent tumah in it, and that makes it tameh without any exogenous tumah touching it. Nevertheless, when it comes to hechsher mayim, it would still require hechsher mayim. And so that would be the answer for Rav Sheshet, that even here, the Tuma Kala requires Hekshet. It says, Maishna Hekshet Sheret Delo Bayit. What's the reason that it doesn't require outside Tuma to make it Tamei? Kiditana de Rabbi Shmuel. Because of the Brayta from the Beit Midrash of Rabbi Shmuel. Hekshet Mayim Nami Loti Bayit. In that similar vein, it shouldn't require priming to be Mikabel Tuma. Kiditana de Bei Rabbi Shmuel. Because the same Brayta of Rabbi Ishmael, Titana Debei Rabbi Ishmael, we have the Brayta of Rabbi Ishmael, that says at the end of Parshat Shmini, I'll call Zera Zerua Asher Yizareya, so that is the pasuk that deals with Heksher, the Kabul Tuma, Mazraim, Chain Sofam Letamei Tuma Chamura, just like by Zraim, which will never attain a high level of Tuma, they can never become an Ava Tuma, Uchlim, by definition, are always at the level of Tuma that cannot be Mitamei Adam, and they also don't receive Tuma at a level that makes them into an Ava Tuma. So even if a mate touches Ochel, the Ochel will still only be a Rishon the Tuma, it will not be an Ava Tuma. So Ochlim are the topic of the Pasuk, and just like the Zera Zerua, the Ochlim there in the Pasuk, are items that will never reach that high level of Tuma, so too, anything that doesn't reach a high level of Tuma requires Heksher. Tzrichim Heksher. Av kol shein sofan letamei Tuma Chamura. Tzrichim Heksher. So too, any other item that doesn't reach Tuma Chamura will require Heksher. Yatzta Nevela Tov Tahor. The exception to that, or what is not included in that pasuk, is Nevela Tov Tahor, shesofo letamei Tuma Chamura shein tzrich Heksher. Since it will attain Tuma Chamura in the end, it does not require Heksher. And over there, we're clearly speaking about Heksher of priming to be Mikabel Tuma. That's the topic of the pasuk, that a liquid went over these items, and it causes them to be primed to be Mikabel Tuma. And you see from that pasuk that we don't include a Nevela Tov Tahor. Nevela Tov Tahor is the exception. It's precluded or excluded by that pasuk, therefore it doesn't need priming to be Mikabel Tuma. So if that's the case, this is a little bit of a problem for Rav Sheshet, because when it comes to Nevela Tov Tahor, it does not require priming, doesn't require Hekshter, the Kabul Tuma. It also does not require that an outside Tuma touch it. It doesn't require Hekshter at all. And Rav Sheshet made a statement that when it comes to Tuma Chamura, you don't require Hekshter, but Tuma Kala, you do require Hekshter. Well, here's a case of Tuma Kala, which is the Nevela Tov Tahor before you swallow it, whereas Tuma Tochlim. And you see, it doesn't require any Hekshter. El Amar Rava of Itaim Rav Papa. So the answer to that, Rava says, or some say it in the name of Rav Papa, Shum Tuma Chamura Ba'olam, Shum Tuma Kala Ba'olam. That when you're dealing with the category of Tuma Chamura, and when you're dealing with the category of Tuma Kala, then this is true. In the world of Tuma Chamura, we don't require Hekshter. Whereas by the world of Tuma Kala, Ochlim, even though this particular item doesn't require Hekshter, any other Ochel that has a shame to Makala associated with it does require Hekshter. So it might not be true in this particular item or for this particular case, but in general, when it comes to Tuma Chamura, it does not require Hekshter. When it comes in general to Tuma Toklim, it does require Hekshter. Even though in this particular case it doesn't require Hekshter, nevertheless in general it does. Given that contrast, then it makes it that there should be a distinction that remains. And so then your Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri's kavachomer is not a fair kavachomer. Just because there's no requirement of makshava for Tuma Chamura doesn't mean that there is no requirement of makshava for Tuma Kala. Just like there is no need for Hekshter for Tuma Chamura, but there is a need for Hekshter by Tuma Kala. It is, in essence, making up for the deficit, which is that Tuma Chamura doesn't need all this because it's such a high level of Tuma, so it doesn't require Makshava, it doesn't require Hekshter. Tuma Kala, which is a lower form of Tuma, requires both Makshava and Hekshter. And that's the distinction. The Baal HaTosafot asked over here, I noted it yesterday, that it would have been easier to say, instead of dealing with Hekshter, it would have been easier just to speak about Makshava. It says, Tema, Difarish, Haftatani, Eni Yeredakach, Makshava Gufa. About the requirement for makshava. Delo matzina tuma chamura shetzricha makshava b'tzum makom. When it comes to tuma chamura, you never need to have makshava to make it into tuma chamura. Doesn't matter whether you know it's tuma chamura. Doesn't matter whether you think about it. It happens. It's inherently Tumah Chamura. Nevela is Nevela. No matter what you think, and no matter what has happened to the animal, it's a Nevela. But the opposite is not true. When it comes to Tumah Kala, you require Machshobon to make it into Tumat Ochlim. And he brings the classic example, which is by Nevela. Nevela doesn't require any Machshobah or Hefsher to become Nevela. Then for Tumat Ochlim, it does require Machshobah. And so you see that that distinction exists. Forgetting about Hefsher, you don't have to talk about categories of Tumat Chamura, categories of Tumat Kala to avoid the problem of Rav Sheshit. You can make an outright statement. Tumat Chamura doesn't require Machshobah. Tumat Ochlim requires Machshobah. And that's it. So he says, I'm not sure why the Gemara didn't go down that path. Meo, he says, maybe Nevela Nami Bin and Shtei Ruya the Ger, the Bar Podo. Maybe there is such a concept by Nevela that you do require a Machshava. It's not really a Machshava. It's just the fact that it has to be Ra'ui the Ger in order for it to still be classified as a Nevela. So I don't know if you'd call that a Machshava, that it has to be intended for. It is just a threshold, which is that it must meet the standard that it would be good for a ger to have it, not necessarily that you have intent for a ger to have it. Tosafot leaves that as a tzarchion as to why the Gemara didn't use that. Part of the reason might be because that's the etzem kal v'chomer of Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri. You can't, in a sense, disprove him from the kal v'chomer that he's making. Which is he's saying that there is no need for machshava by Tumah Chamura. So too, by this Tumah Kala, there should be no need for Makshava. And you come back and say, no, there is a requirement of Makshava by Tumah Kala, not by Tumah Chamura. And he'll say to you, you're right, but not in this instance because of the Kal V'chomer. So it might be that because it's a undermining of Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri from the structure, the framework that he's setting up, maybe it's not strong, a rejection of the Kal V'chomer, even though you technically could say that it's just following a pattern that is apparent in everywhere else in halacha, that Tumah Chamura doesn't require Machshava, Tumah Kala does, and then why would you want to make an exception here to say there is a Kal V'chomer? Alright, so now the Gemara moves on and says, Amar Rava, Moder Rabbi Yochanan Le'inyan Maser, De Machshevet Chibur, Shma Machshava. So Rava says that Rabbi Yochanan agrees that when it comes to Masrot, that having a Machshava while it's still attached to the ground has impact. We started out this sugya on the second half of yesterday's daf, with the statement of Amar Rabba Bar Chanan Rav Yochanan Ushin endives shezaran mitkilad beima that were originally planted for animal feed v'nimla chaleim le'adam and then you changed your mind to make them for human consumption tzricha machshava le'kishitalshu you need to have machshava after they're already harvested after already they're taken out of the ground to make it into tumat ochlim to make it ro'i le'adam because the machshava you have when it's attached to the ground does not work or is not meaningful. That's how we started the sugya that we're in now. What Rava comes along to say is that Rabbi Yochanan only says that by tumat ochlim that you can't do it. When it comes to maser, even if you change your mind while it's in the ground, it still has impact that when you take it out of the ground, when you pick it, it is ra'ui le'achilat adam, and you'll be chayav in tumot or masrot. It'll turn out that if you have such a machshava while it's attached to the ground, when it's harvested, it will be chayav in shumot masrot, but it would not be subject to tumat ochlim unless you have that machshava after it's already picked. And Gemara says, Amar Rava, mina aminolo. How can I prove this to you? It's none. We have a mishnah in masrot, hasia, which is penny royal, ve'zov and hyssop, ve'akoranit, savory, Shibechatzer, that are grown in the chatzer, imayu nishmarim, if they are guarded, chayavin, then they are chayav in masrot. Hey chidomi, what exactly is the scenario here? Ilayim adizarinu mitchila la'adam, if you originally planted them for human consumption, tzricha lameimar, you need to tell me that they're chayav in shumot masrot, that seems pretty straightforward. Elav dizarinu mitchila la'beima, must have been that they were originally planted for animal feed, Biktani, and it says, Imayu nishmarin chayavim. If they were guarded, then they are chayavin. Now we're assuming that means that if he intended them now for human consumption, that's what the word nishmarin means, so that they were nishmarin lachilat adam, and that changed them from animal feed into human consumption, and you are chayav in shumot masrot, even though you had that in mind while they were still attached to the ground. I'm Ravashi. Ravashi says, no. You can explain nishmarim differently. Hacha b'chatzer, shalom me'elehen askinan. Dealing with a chatzer in which they grew by themselves. They were not planted. Ustama l'adam kaimo. And in general, these are used for human consumption, and therefore they would be chayav in Trumot u'Maasrot. V'halchi kamar. And this is what's meant by the Mishnah. Im ha-chatzer mishameret peiroteha. If the chatzer protects that which is inside of it, chayavin. Then you're chayav in Trumot u'Maasrot. V'im lav. If not, then you are turim. Which means that we're using the word nishmarim now, not to mean that you changed it from being for behema to being for Adam, but rather that simply is it not hefker. These items, if they grow by themselves and they're not protected in any way, then they're hefker. If they're hefker, they're not going to be chayav in Shemot Masrot. So that's what it says here. If they grow by themselves and they're found in a chatzer, which then gives them protection, then they're no longer hefker and they would be chayav in Shemot and Masrot. Tosfot says over here, the reason that there's emphasis on chatzer is because, first of all, it's not normal to plant them there. Normally you plant them out in the gina, not in the chatzer. Number two is, when you plant something in the chatzer, then the default is it for human consumption, because when it's in the chatzer, it's under the watchful eye of the individual, which is usually because you would do such in order to plant it for your own purposes. And Tosfot says, keep an eye on it to see when you should actually pick it, so it doesn't get hard and ruined. You pick it at the right time. So all of that seems to lean towards it being ra'oi le'adam, being planted specifically for human consumption. And that makes sense according to what the Gemara is saying now, that it grew by itself in the chatzer, that the properties of the chatzer make it that you would have default basis assumed that it was for human consumption, even though it grew by itself. And that would be true, again, that its default is for human consumption only when it's grown in the chatzer. When it's not grown in the chatzer, it would sound more like that the default is the other way around, that it would be animal feed and not for human consumption. So now, Meitiv Ravashi. Ravashi now questions Rava's contention here with regards to Rav Yochanan's position that a machshevet chibur would have impact the gabe maser, but would not have impact the gabe tumat ochlim. Because kol shechevin b'masrot, itamim tumat ochlim. The mission that we saw yesterday, anything that's chayav in shemot masrot, is also going to be mitameh tumat ochlim. That's because we saw yesterday the requirements for something to be chayav in maser is ochel, that's to be a food. Nishmar, it's not hefker, it's something that's kept with private ownership. V'gidulo min haaretz, and it grows from the ground. Tumat ochlim doesn't have any of those requirements except the fact that it be ochel. So if something is chayav in maser, by definition it will also be subject to tumat ochlim. V'mita. He says to Rava, if you are correct in what you're saying, ha'ika hane. According to you, these are scenarios de mechayavin b'maser v'mitamim tumat ochlim. According to you, you can have items where, while it was attached to the ground, you switched it from being animal feed to for human consumption, meaning that originally it was planted for animals, and then in the middle, while it's planted in the ground, you say, you know what, I'm going to keep it for human consumption. That change of mind will be impactful with regards to Trumot u'Maasrot, which means you're going to be chayav in Trumot u'Maasrot, will not be impactful for Trumat Ochlim, which means you will not have Trumat Ochlim, and that means that you now have an example that undermines the principle of the Mishnah. The principle of the Mishnah is anything chayav in Maser is also subject to Trumat Ochlim. You have a whole class of items now that could be chayav in Trumot u'Maasrot, yet not subject to Trumat Ochlim. Amarova ochi kamar. This is how you have to read the Mishnah. Any species, category of items that is chayav in Shemot Masrot is also subject to Tumat Ochlim. It's not talking about this particular item or this particular case. It's saying in general, if it's chayav in Shemot Masrot, it also could be subject to Tumat Ochlim. There might be cases or particular instances where that's not true, but generically or generally, this is true with regards to that grouping category species. Hakanami Mistavro says that explanation of the Mishnah from yesterday's daf makes sense, Miktani Seifa, because of the latter part of the Mishnah, which is on the second half of today's daf, which is Kol Shechayav Reshita Geiz. Any animal that is subject to Reshita Geiz, which means the first of the shearings, animals that you shear, the first of the shearings given to the Kohen, belong to the Kohen. The Gemara in Chulin discusses this extensively as to how much, when it is, what makes you chayav. Chayav v'matanot. Such an animal is then also subject to the din of matanot kuhuna, which come from an animal that is chulin, which is the zroah, lechayayim, and the keba. Those three sections of the animal belong to the kohen. So So if you're subject to Reshita Geis, you're also subject to this Chiyuv Matanot. V'yesh Chayav Matanot. There's some animals that are Chayav Matanot. Vein Chayav Reshita Geis. Yet they don't have the din of Reshita Geis. For instance, cattle. Cattle which are kosher animals, subject to the din of Matanot, Zra Lechayayim and Keba, has to be given to the Kohen. Yet, obviously, there's no Reshita Geis, because they don't have anything to shear. So it could be you're Chayav in Matanot, but you're not Chayav in Reshita Geis. Vim Ita. If you are correct that you have to read the Mishnayot, literally, that every case is to fit the model of the Mishnah, then Hayika Treifa. What about a Treifa? To Chayav in Reshita Geis. Treifa has no influence over Reshita Geis, because why does it matter? You're shearing the animal while it's alive. Treifa or not Treifa, the shearings came off. That's what makes you Chayav. Veinu Chayav in Matanot. On the other hand, when it comes to the matanot, only a behemat chulin that is edible by the balim has a din of matanot lekuna. If it's an animal that can't be eaten by the balim, it's a treifa, then there's no din of matanot of giving it to the kohen. So you see that there is an exception to the case there as well. It's going to be chayav in reshita geis. It's going to be patur mi matanot. So that breaks the model of the Mishnah that says anything that has reshita geis has matanot. So how do you answer? The answer is that treifa is one unusual case. Generically or generally, it's true. If you're chayav and reshita geis for these animals, you're also subject to matanot for these animals. This particular animal, it's not true about. But these animals, or the category of the animal where it's found, is generally that way. That would be the din. Amar Ravina. Ravina says you don't have to say that. Hamani, Rabbi Shimoni. You could just say the author of our Mishnah on the second half of today's daf is Rabbi Shimon, the Daniel. Rabbi Shimon puter et treifa meshita geis. We have such an opinion. Rabbi Shimon, who believes that treifa not only affects matanot, but also affects reshita geis. Once you do that and make Rabbi Shimon the author, then you've eliminated that exceptional case. And now it fits. Even for particular cases, it fits. Because even in that particular case, it will be true. You won't be chayav in reshita geis, and you won't be chayav in matanot. Amar Rav Shimi ba'ashi tashma. I can show you that Rava is correct from this. Hamafkir et karmo. Person who disowns his vineyard. This is found in the Gemara of Baba Kama, discusses this extensively. He says, Vishkim baboker, gets up the next morning, ubatzro, and he goes ahead and harvests it. He picks all the grapes, chayav, uperet, uba ololot, ubishikha, upeya. He's chayav in all of these matnot aniim, even though in general, matnot aniim are turim when it is hefker. And he was mafkirit. Nevertheless, for these four matnot aniim, he is chayav, upator mina maser. But as far as maser is concerned, he is pator, because we saw before that one of the three qualifications to be chayav in maser is ochel, nishmar, gidulo mina karka. Nishmar means it's not hefker. If it is hefker, you're not chayav in masrot. The truth is, you also should not be chayav in peret, ololot, and shikha and peya, because they're also pturim min hefker. But the Gemara in Bava Kamma explains that there is a riboy with regards to these items. Because in Parshat Ki Teitzeh, when it speaks about the terem, it says, Ki tachbot zeitcha lo tifayer acharecha. When you harvest the olives, don't go back and take away the pe'er, the glory. Va'amar mar, lo tital tifarto mimenu, don't take away its glory. V'hainu pe'ya, that's the pe'ya. V'darshina v'sifrei, and in the sifrei we say acharecha. What does it mean? Behind you. Zo shechecha. That has to do with when you forget something, don't go back and take it. Uchtiv, and over there in the pasuk it says, you give it, leger, leyatom, ulealmana, iye. All of those things belong to them. The next pasuk which we quoted was Ki tinzor karmacha lote olel acharecha lager layatom v'almana iye. So there you have the din of ololot. So now you have in these two psukim peya, shechecha, and ololot. Sounds like these three items have to be given lager layatom ulalmana. And the problem is, why do you need these psukim? Or truthfully, if you have these psukim, why do you need the psukim that are found in Parshat Kiddushim? Which is that the same dinim appear, Mishnah Torah already appeared in Parshat Kiddushim, in the beginning of Parshat Kiddushim. Ubekut zrechem et kitzir atzachem, lo techale patzat chalik tzor, veleke kitzir chalok telekeit, vikarmecha lo teolel, uperet karmecha lo telekeit, leani, velager, tazobotam ani, Hashem elokeichem. So the Gemara in Baba Kama says, why is there a duplication of this idea of Lani v'lager tazov otam? The Gemara says, yesh tazov yitera. There's an additional leaving that is mentioned by these matnotanim. It says tazov otam here, and it says it in Mishnah Torah as well. From that we learn, tazov otam, the rabot hefker. That tells you that even though here there's a karmacha, kitzircha, all of them are possessive forms, which seem to indicate you need ownership over it. Nevertheless, the extra tazov otam says you must leave them even in the face of hefker. Now that's not true of real hefker. If you really were mafkir it and you gave it away and disowned it and you had nothing to do with it, then eno chanami, they would be pturim not only from trumot masrot, they'd also be pturim from all the other matnot aniyim, including the ones that we mentioned here, which are peret ololot, shikha, and peyah. But in this scenario where you're mafkir it at night and the next morning you go basically and repossess it, that type of hefker works for trumot masrot. It does not work for these matnot aniyim because they have an extra tazov otam. That tells you even in the face of this quasi-hefker or denunciation of ownership, it is not sufficient to rid you of the obligation of peretz ololot, shikha, and peyah. But what you see from here is that you have now an inconsistency with the Mishnayot that we saw yesterday. Ba'anatznan, we saw in the Mishnah yesterday, kosher chayav v'peyah, chayav v'masrot. If you're chayav and leaving peyah, then you're also chayav v'masrot. That's because peyah has five requirements, and masrot only have three requirements. Those three requirements are three of the five requirements for peyah. So it's obvious if you're chayav in peyah, you're also going to be chayav in masrot, but not vice versa. And over here, that's not true. We just brought you a case in which if you're mafkir your kerem, and the next morning you get up and you harvest it, where you are chayav in peyah and patur min amaser. So again, that seems to undermine the principle of the Mishnah. Ella, what you have to say is, it speaks about the item there, it's not speaking about the particular item, particular case. It's speaking about this genre, this species, that is true. In general, this species will be chayav in peyah, it also will be chayav in masrot. It's not telling you there aren't particular cases where you could be chayav in peyah and patur min masrot. But those are unique cases where you do something unusual. But absent that, the general principle is, if you're chayav in peyah, you're a chayav in masrot. Again, that would be supportive of Rava's contention that the Mishnah is not problematic for him, that even though Rav Yochanan has this divergent view, which is that if you have a makshava b'chibur, it's not good enough for tumat ochlim, yet it is good enough for maser, which then brought up the inconsistency, which is you could be chayav in masrot, yet not be subject to tumat ochlim, despite the fact that a Mishnah said that if you're chayav in maser, then by definition, you are subject to tumat ochlim. We don't see that as an undermining or a problem for Rabbi Yochanan's position, because as Rava says, the Mishnah is not speaking to particular cases, it's speaking generically. Generically, a species, a type, that is chayav and maser, will also be subject to tumat ochlim. Our case happens to be an exception to the rule, whereby it will be subject to masrot, will not be subject to tumat ochlim, because machshevet chibur is impactful for maser, it is not impactful for tumat ochlim. It's not autumn. We have a Mishnah in Peah. Modim chachamim le Rabbi Akiva. Chachamim agreed to Rabbi Akiva bezoreya shevet. If any plants dill, o chardal or mustard, v'shnayim v'shlosha mikomot, in two or three different places, shenotein peah the kol echad ve'achad. You'll take off peah from each one of them. We saw before, we saw machloket yesterday, with regards to rows of onions and garlics that were in between other vegetables, whether you take off peyah on each row or you take off a peyah and all of those rows on an aggregated basis. It's a similar machloket here between the Chachamim and Rabbi Akiva with regards to a sadeh minumar. Minumar means like spotted type of field in which you go around harvesting the field in a not exactly haphazard manner, but it looks haphazard. You're only going and picking the ones that are already dried out or ripened, and you're leaving the younger, moister ones still to come back again. So it turns out that you have spots of the field that are harvested, here, spots there, but it's not a continuous harvest. When you come back and harvest the ones that you skipped over, what's the din over there? So Rabbi Akiva says, once you pull out all those spotted areas and you leave behind now sections and sections of the field that are not harvested, when you come back and harvest each one of those sections, you're going to have to give peyah for each one of those sections independently. because the empty space now breaks between them and they're not considered a single field. Whereas the Chachamim say that you take me'achad alakol, you take off pe'ah on all of those that are left over, because this is just classified as the end of your harvest or continuation of your harvest. It's not a new harvest, and therefore you don't have to give separate pe'ah on each of these patches, because they're just really a continuation of the earlier harvest that you had begun. Others explain that that machlok between Rabbi Akiva and Chachamim is about the beginning of the harvest. When you first took out pieces of it, do you need to take payoff of each of those pieces that you took off? Or can you just classify that as the beginning of the harvest, and therefore you're going to come back and do the rest, so you'll fill it in, and therefore it's considered to be one big harvest? And that's the view of the Chachamim. Others say it's about both, the beginning and the end. Rabbi Akiva thinks you need to take off payoff for each piece when you first take it off, and when you come back and do each piece. Whereas the Chachamim say it's all part of one big harvest, and therefore you only need to take off one payah. So here the Chachamim agree with Rabbi Akiva with regards to Shevet and Chardal, since they're normally planted in this sectional way, that each little patch or section that's planted that way is an independent field, and therefore each one of them will require their own payah. And that is because you don't make patches of them. These aren't the type of items that you plant in large tracts. They plant them in smaller areas amongst the other items or amongst the other patches of vegetables. And the way it's harvested, it's also harvested in that manner. Ve'ha shevet demechayev pe'peah u'mechayev b'maser. So now you have this shevet, which is subject to pe'ah, and is also subject to maser. It's not. You have a mishnah. Kol shechayav pe'ah, chayav b'maser. Anything that is chayav in pe'ah, then would also be subject to maser. And now let me take the next stage. This is transitive logic, which is if A is true, then B is true, and if B is true, then C is true. That means if A is true, then C is also true. So over here, if you have something that's chayav in pe'ah, it's chayav in maser. Because of the mission that says anything chayav in pe'ah is chayav in maser, then we also have a mission that says, mit chayav in maser, mit tamei tumat ochlim. Anything that's chayav in maser is also subject to tumat ochlim. That means that if these items are chayav in pe'ah, they are definitely subject to tumat ochlim based on this transitive property. Alma, kol milei da'aved l'tayma, mit tamei tumat ochlim. So from this you would conclude that anything that is done for flavor is subject to tumat ochlim. Because these are spices. These are items that are grown for their flavor. And we're saying, number one, chayav in pe'ah. Number two, chayav in maser. And number three, now, subject to tumat ochlim. Da'ai shevet le'tama avido. Because the dill is only planted for its flavor. Verimini, is this really true? So we set up the understanding here. Once we set up the understanding, now we bring the question. The question is, hakosht kostis, which is one of the ingredients of the ketoret, ve'achimum, which is either pyrethrum, which is a type of garden plant. Rashi says that it's part of the ginger family, more along the lines of amamum. Roshei bisamim is either these principal spices or fragrant herbs. Ve'atia, which is either crawfoot or pennyroyal. Rashi over here associates tia, hainu si'a, with the si'a that we saw in the previous amud, that is pennyroyal. Tosafot disagrees with that and says that doesn't make so much sense because we have different dinim with regards to si'a and tia. Says v'yesh lamar b'davka b'chatzer, maybe the si'a that we saw in the previous amud is only in the chatzer. That's why it has a different din than the tia that's mentioned here. Or maybe there are two different minim, and not like Rashi suggests that it's the same thing. And then you have the chiltit, which is either asafutia or chittis. Vapilpilim and peppers. Vechalat karia, which is cakes of safflower. And you can see that in Rashi, because he says that this chalat karia is krug, vehu karkom, which is saffron. So all of these items, these are names of spices. Nikachim bekesef maaser. You have ma'aser sheni money, you're allowed to purchase them. Ve'ena mitamim tumat ochlim, but they do not have tumat ochlim, divrei Rabbi Akiva. Kesef ma'aser sheni has a requirement that you use it for ochlim, that you use it for food substances. Rabbi Akiva says you can purchase it with monies of ma'aser sheni, but they aren't subject to tumat ochlim. Amar lo, Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri, Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri says you got to be consistent. Im nikachim b'kesef maser, if you can buy them with kesef maser, which means that they are claim, mipnei ma'im mitamim tumat ochlim, then why wouldn't it be subject to tumat ochlim? V'meina mitamim, if they don't have tumat ochlim, af heim yukachu b'maser, then why should they be allowed to be purchased with the monies of ma'aseh sheni? You need to be consistent in your view as to whether it's ochel or it's not ochel. If it's ochel, you can buy it with kesef ma'aseh sheni, and it will be subject to tumat ochlim. Whereas, if it isn't, then you can't do either one of them. You can't have a mix and match. They went to a consensus. They went to a vote to decide what the halacha is. That the truth is that they're not considered to be ochel, and therefore you can't purchase them with kesef ma'aser sheni, and they're not mitamei tumat ochlim. Tell us the photo over here says, is that really true? Because we have other examples of items where you're allowed to buy them with kesef ma'aser sheni, yet they're not subject to tumat ochlim. He brings example of a core, he brings example of animals. All of these items where you can use monies of ma'aser sheni, and yet they are not mitamei tumat ochlim. An animal that's alive isn't mekabel tumah, yet it is allowed to be bought with kesef ma'aser sheni. And by core also, it says that it's not mitamei tumat ochlim, yet you can buy it with kesef ma'aser sheni. So in both these cases, it says that the reason being is that each of these items in the end will have tumat ochlim in it. May not be right now in the present that it has tumat ochlim, but in the future they will be subject to tumat ochlim, and therefore even now, prior to their attaining that ability to have tumat ochlim, you're allowed to purchase them because they can easily be converted into ochel. So anything that can be easily converted into ochel will be allowed to be purchased with the kesef ma'aser sheni, and will at some point reach tumat ochlim. So now we have the principle over here that we're establishing with regards to these spices by which you have to be consistent. And the consistent view is that they are not ochel, and that they are not allowed to be bought with monies of ma'aser sheni. Given that, it shows you that what is the common denominator between all the items that we listed here? They're all types of spices. Since they're all types of spices, they are letama, they are for flavor. What you see here is things that are for flavor don't have tumat ochlim and aren't subject to ma'aser sheni. Then what did you do with the shevet before? You said the dill was subject to peah, therefore subject to ma'aser, therefore subject to tumat ochlim. And over here we have a braita telling us just the opposite, that it's not subject to tumat ochlim because it is a spice, it's for flavor. So how are you going to reconcile that? So Rav Chista, Ketanya hi, b'shevet asuya likhmach. It depends on what you use the shevet for. If you use the dill for what is known as kutach hababli, which was a dip that was a favorite of the Babylonians, it included moldy bread, aged cheese, and salt. It was a very potent type of dip. And seemingly the dill was added to it. The shevet was a part of this kutach hababli. So if you use the shevet for that purpose, it's not considered to be a spice or a flavoring item, but rather it's considered to be an integral part of the item. And that's what Rashi says. The halav l'tayma of it. In that case, it's not made for its flavor, but have a ikar. It's an integral part of the dish itself, and therefore it will be subject to tumat ochlim and will be subject to tumat masrot. Instead of being just a flavor or a spice, it's a ochel now. Amravashi, Amrita the Shmaite Kameh Rav Kahana. I said over this answer of Rav Chista, the whole sugya, and then the answer of Rav Chista to Rav Kahana, and he said to me, Lo tema b'shevet asuya lechmach. Don't say it's the dill that is specifically designated for the purposes of kutach habavli, hastamalik teira, which would imply the default of shevet is to be flavorful, to be a spice, to spice the dishes. Ela stam shevet lechmach asuya. It's the other way around. The default usage of shevet is for this chmach, which is that it's an ochel. If you designate a likteira, then it takes on the status of a spice, and it won't be subject to tumat ochlim. But then might be still subject to masrot and peah, but won't attain tumat ochlim, because as we said yesterday, spices that can be eaten in their raw state, or are eaten in their raw state, and also are made into a spice, that they are still subject to masrot, like onions, garlic, basil, all the things that we mentioned yesterday, this would be similar to that, because its purpose is to be used as is, but it also is used as a spice. But that would mean that it's still subject to masrot and peyah, but not subject if it's used as a spice to tumat ochlin. Tznan, we have a mishnah, hashevet, mishenitna tam bikdera. The shevet, once it gives its flavor to the dish, einba mishum tuma, veino mitama tumat ochlin. That once it gives over the flavor, it's no longer subject to tuma, it's no longer subject to tumat ochlin. Ha, from there you would infer, until it does give that flavor to the dish, then it does have a din of tumat or masrot, and it is mitamei tumat ochlim. If you think that the default status of shevet is to be used as a spice, to spice up the dishes, when it's not put in as a spice, that's its default purpose, and it shouldn't be subject to tumat ochlim and ella lav shmamina. That stama lichma chasuya, its default status is to be used for kuta chababli, and only when you change your mind about it, or you use it in this other fashion, does it then go down the other path and lose its shame. Tumat ochlim, shmamina. So you see from that the default status of shevet is to have tumat ochlim, is not to be classified as a spice, but if you do it and make it into a spice, then it would not be subject to tumat ochlim, and in that way we can reconcile all of this, first of all, by saying that Shevet is Chayav Epeya, Chayav Emaser, and will be subject to Tumat Ochlim because its default status to be used in Kutach HaBavli. That makes it into an Ochel, and that's why it's subject to all these items. If you make it into a spice, then it will no longer be Chayav in Tumat Masrot once it's given its flavor, and will no longer be a problem of Tumat Ochlim once it's conveyed its flavor. That's because you've converted it then from being something inherently that's an ochel into something that's been used as a spice or a flavor, and that's why it will lose its status at that point. But absent that, it will be chayav in trumot and masrot, just like we discussed yesterday with other spices that have dual usage, so that they will be subject to trumot and masrot. And even once they're made into a spice, they still have that din. The only thing that will change is the issue of tumat ochlim. Tumat ochlim, as well as the fact that once it's imparted its flavor as a spice, if it falls into something else, even if it's truma, it won't affect that other item, because its utility has already been garnered, which is the spiced something. The flavor's been spent already, and it would not be subject to baking something else into truma at that time. That's what was said here in the Mishnah that we quoted. Right, next Mishnah. This is the Mishnah we just quoted in the sugya that we saw before. Is subject to the din of giving matnot chulin to the kohen, the zroa, the chayayim, and the keba. There are certain things that are chayav in matnot, which we already noted is cattle, which are subject to matnot, but don't have a din of reshita geiz. Anything that requires elimination from the house during shvi'it, yeshlo shvi'it, also has kedushat shvi'it. But yeshlo shvi'it, there's certain things that have kedushat shvi'it, vein lo bior, but they don't have to be removed from the house. So Rashi explains over here, this is a major machloket rishonim as to how this works and what the ramifications of this are. Rashi says with regards to shvi'it, it has kedushat shvi'it. What are the implications of kedushat shvi'it? Rashi says there are three things. Yesh l'inyan shechayav afkir. You have to renounce ownership over it. You're not allowed to exert ownership over a perot shvi'it that are kadosh. That's one thing. Vasur la'sotan schora. You're not allowed to transact and trade in them. You can't use them commercially if they have kedushat shvi'it. Umlugma vafiktvizin. You can't use it for something to make into a salve, for a medicinal salve. And you can't use it as a something that causes a person to throw up. Because those are not utility where you're getting hana through the consumption of the item. You're utilizing it and then the hana is not coming at the time of the consumption, or there is no hana from it. It is spit out afterwards. None of these are proper uses of something that has kedushat shvi'it. That is the ramifications of kedushat shvi'it. There are other, it's just interesting to note over here that Rashi says that you're chayav lafkir, which makes it sound like you have to actively denounce your ownership or release these items to the public, which is also a machloket rishonim, is whether it's afkalta de malka, whether a shvi'it happens automatically because it's the king's decree that you lose ownership over the items, Or do you have to actually release your ownership over the items? So it's interesting, Rashi says, Chayav Lafkir. It's also interesting if there are ramifications to this. The Bali Tosafot at the end of Yevamot mentioned the fact that if one is Shomer, Peirot Shvit, that have Kedushat Shvit, it actually makes them Asurim, makes them problematic. That's not the view of most Rishonim, where it's a sur to exert ownership, but if you do exert ownership over them, they don't inherently become a sur. You violated the Din Torah, but the fruits or vegetables themselves don't become problematic. There's a second din with regards to Peirot Shvit, which is the requirement for Biur. That something that has Kedushat Shvi'it, there's a point in time where you may no longer keep it in your house. And that is because there's a principle that the Gemara establishes with regard to Shvi'it, which is Kala the Kayam in a Sadeh. When the animals out in the field can't find this item anymore in the fields from that which is left out there, then Kala the Beimam in a Bayit. Then you have to eliminate it from your house, that which you kept for the animals in the house. Or in essence, when the item disappears from outside, then whatever you have in the house from that period of Shvi'it, you have to eliminate, you have to do Bi'ur, which means that you have to remove it from your possession. How you remove it from your possession is a major machloket Rishonim, as to whether you have to actually burn it, eliminate it, or simply being mafkirit. Rashi in a number of places indicates that you have to destroy it. The Ramban and others suggest that you just have to be mafkirit, you just have to denounce ownership, you put it out, and you're mafkirit. So there is this requirement for Bi'ur, from your house, of any item that you have that you took properly on Shvi'it, or if you took it improperly, that has to be eliminated once it no longer is available in the Sadeh. So what the Mishnah is noting is that if you have Bi'ur, the requirement to be eliminated from the house, then obviously you have Kedushat Shvi'it. The other way around is not true. You could have Kedushat Shvi'it and not have an obligation to eliminate it from the house. That's because there are certain items that never disappear from the field or are out in the field for a long, long duration and therefore don't require a Bi'ur. That's what the Gemara is going to explain now. Kigom, what's an example of these items? Alei alof shoteh veha dandina, the leaves of these particular items. And the truth is that, as Rashi notes, they could have brought other examples. These are not unique, but they are unique because of the seifa of what we're going to bring here. So the leaves of the lofa shoteh is the arum, and the hadandina is the mid-waist. So those items, they have biur, and they have Kedushat Shvi'it.
Yesh.
Sheyesh lo Shvi'it, vein lo Bi'ur. Items that have Shvi'it but do not have Bi'ur. Ikar halofa shoteh. That's the root of the lofa shoteh of the Arum. The Ikar ha-dandino. As well as the root of the mid-waist. They are different than the leaves. So the reason they brought the leaves in the Reisha is because they have the opposite in the Sefer where it's the roots. But the truth is that almost every item is the true of the Reisha, which is most items have Bi'ur and have Shvi'it, because they eventually disappear from the field. Therefore, they have a requirement to be put out of the house, and they're subject to Kedushat Shvi'it. These are the exceptions on the other side, which is that they have a din of Kedushat Shvi'it, yet they do not have a din of Bi'ur. And that is because, Dichtiv, Ulebem Techa, Ulechaya Asher Baratzecha, Tiekol Tvuat Alecho. It says in Parshat Pahar with regards to Shvi'it, it will be for the animals, Bem Techa, the domesticated animals. The chaya, the wild animals in the land, all of the grain, all of your harvest will be for them to eat. Kol machia chaya uchelet min hasadeh is what I noted before. As long as the chaya has what to find in the field, atam achilu b'mtecha b'bayit, then you're allowed to use these perot shvi'it, these items, and feed them to your animals in the house. Kala l'chaya min hasadeh, once it's no longer available to the animals in the field, kala l'b'mtecha shib'bayit, then you can't feed it anymore to the animals in the house. It will no longer be available to them. That's either because you have to destroy it, or you have to maybe mafkir it, you have to disown it, it won't be available to them. Bahane lo kalalohu. These roots stick around for a long time. They don't disappear. They're always there. Since they're always there, there is no biur for them, even though there is kedushat shvi'it. And the Mishnayot and Shvi'it also bring other examples of items. Their shvi'it is actually not in the seventh year, but in a different year, because they start growing in the seventh year, and they only appear a couple of years later. And obviously then their biur will also be off-kilter because of their shvi'it being off-kilter. Or if it's an item that sticks around for a number of years, it may not have biur for a number of years afterwards, or it may not have biur at all. All right, next Mishnah. Kol sheyesh lo kaskeset, yesh lo snafir. This is by fish, the kosher simanim of fish. Anything that has scales automatically has fins. Yesh, yesh, lo snapir, vein lo kaskeset. There's certain things that have fins, but do not have scales. Kosh yesh lo karnayim, yesh lo talfayim. Anything that has horns has hooves, meaning that if it has horns, then it has split hooves. Yesh yesh lo talfayim, vein lo karnayim. But there are things that have split hooves that don't have horns. For example, a pig. Pig has split hooves, but does not have horns. But the other way around, if it has horns, then it does have split hooves. The Gemara and Chulin discuss which type of horns, what the horns have to look like in order for this to be true. But there is this din whereby there is a correlation between these two items in one direction, but not in the other direction. And the Gemara says, Kosh yesh lo kaskeset, anything that has scales automatically has fins. Dag tahor. That's all the kosher fish. All the kosher fish. They have scales and therefore they have fins. Yesh yesh lo snapir vein lo kaskeset. There are items that have fins but don't have scales. That's dag tamei. That's all the non-kosher fish, like shark, which have fins and don't have scales. Those are items that are dag tamei. It's obvious that that's the distinction. Michte, I don't understand. Anan akaskeset samchinat. In the end, all we look for now is scales, because we know that scales means that it has fins. So then, snapir dichtiv rachmana lamali. Why does the Torah bother to tell us that fins are necessary for the fish to be kosher? If we find scales, then by definition it has fins, and then it is kosher. So why mention snapirim at all? Ilo katav rachmana snapir. Had the Torah not written fins, havamina my kaskeset dichtiv, what is the meaning of kaskeset? Snapir. I would have meant fins. We don't know inherently what the word kaskeset means and snapir means, but once I have both of them, I know one of them is fins and one of them is scales. So the Torah wrote snapir to tell us that kaskeset is not snapir. It says, okay, ba'ashta dichtiv rachmana snapir ve kaskeset milalan de kaskeset levusho. You told me you don't know what the words mean. Now that the Torah wrote snapir and kaskeset, how do you know which one is the fins and which one's the scales? If you told me if you just wrote kaskeset, you weren't sure if that was fins or scales. So I wrote snapir. But how do you know snapir now means fins and kaskeset means scales? Where do you get that information from? Dichtei, because it says by Goliath, Vishiryon kaskasim hulavush. He's wearing chainmail armor, which looks like scales, like armor of scales. That's how we know the word kaskas or kaskeset means scales. Mar says, wait a minute. Now that you know that from the pasuk in Navi, then v'lichto rachmana kaskeset v'lo bayi snapir. If you now know what the meaning of kaskeset is, then you don't have that original havamina that if you just wrote kaskeset, I would have thought that means fins, because we have evidence of the fact that kaskeset means something that you wear, means something that is not the wings of the fish, but rather the clothing or the covering of the fish, which is the scales of the fish. Once you know that, we're back to square one, which is why do you need snapir? So Amar Rabbi Abo, V'chein Tamir, Debei Rabbi Shmuel, Yagdil Torah V'yadir. In order to aggrandize the Torah, it's hard to understand what that means exactly. Either that means because, yes, maybe we could have learned it from the Navi, but the Torah wanted to write it explicitly. So yes, from Navi, we can learn out the word kaskeset, and then we would have known the meaning of kaskeset, and we wouldn't need snapir. But the Torah wrote it so that you would know what kaskeset was, even without the Navi, because you said, if I had snapir and kaskeset, I would have known that it means fins and scales. May not have known which one is which, but I know that it means both of them. So that's why I wrote both of them. So that information now is conveyed from the Torah. You don't need the Navi to tell you that information. Maybe that's what it means, Yagdil Torah V'yadir. Or, in order to indicate that the Torah really is makbid on two simanim, even though they come as a package together. So even though if you have scales, you have fins, and therefore you don't really need to know about fins, nevertheless, that is the Siman Tahara. Siman Tahara is fins and scales, and therefore you need both of them, even though one of them is indicative of the other, and one of them means the other one is present. Still, the Torah wanted to explain that to us. The Baal Yad Tosafot, it's note over here, but it's the way the Gemara answers this question in many other places, which is, came before the story of Goliath came around and was written in the Navi, how did they know that kaskasim meant scales? The Tosafot says what the Gemara answers in many places is that they had a Mesorah, that was the case, and then it was written in the Navi. So that which was written in the Navi was based on the Mesorah, or connected to the Mesorah, and that gave it a permanence, the Dorot, once it was written down, but until that time it was passed the Kabbalah. And Tosafot also just notes, how do you know that fins and scales are required? Maybe one would be sufficient. So he says that it's a Hekesh between fish and Behemah. And just like by the Beima, it's clear that you need both Simonei Torah, chewing its cut, and split hoof, because the Torah enumerates those animals that have one that are not Shevim. So too by the fish, it must mean when it gives you the Simonim, it means you need both of the Simonim, not just one of the Simonim. As far as the veracity of the statement that any fish that has scales has fins, so there are those that believe that that is true in general. There are exceptions to the rule, but all the fish that are found around us have that rule of scales means fins. But there are fish in other places that were not part of the world of Chazal and the world of the Torah at the time, meaning that there are fish found other places in the world that might have the phenomenon of having scales without fins, but that doesn't bother us because the Torah was speaking to the area that we're in. We saw that in Chulin as well, with regards to birds, that Chazal only spoke about the birds that were indigenous to the area where they were. They didn't speak about birds in general and make an absolute statement. So there are some that believe that's the case. Others believe that it's a steadfast rule that if you have scales, you have fins. And if you find fish that seem to be an exception, you need to check whether they really have scales, or maybe they have fins that they drop at a certain point in time, and therefore they do have fins. So you have to work it out if you really believe that this is an absolute statement of fact, that anything that has scales also has fins. All right, now the last of these Mishnayot in that genre is Kol Haton Bracha L'Acharav. Anything that requires a bracha chrona, ton bracha lefanav, requires a bracha rishona. V'yesh ton bracha lefanav, vein ton bracha l'acharav. Some things require a bracha rishona, but do not require a bracha achrona. Tosfos says, don't bring tvilah as an example of an item where you have a bracha afterwards and not before, because you make bracha bala tvilah after you went to the mikveh, not before, because there is a technical problem. The reason you don't make the bracha before you go to the mikveh is because for a ger that's converting, he can't make the bracha beforehand because he's not Jewish beforehand. And whether that is also applicable to our tvilot as well, either because we are tmeim beforehand and it would be inappropriate to make the bracha, or we're not sure that the tvilot is going to work and therefore we only make the bracha afterwards when we do, that's an exception to the rule. It's not part of the rule because there's a compelling reason to make the bracha afterwards. Not because it really belongs afterwards, but because it would be problematic to make it beforehand. Which would also be the same reasoning behind the bracha by candle lighting, where you make the bracha after you lit the candles, not before, because there's a compelling reason to do such, and therefore we move it to afterwards, not because it really belongs afterwards. It really belongs beforehand, but because we can't do it, or there are other mitigating factors beforehand, we force it afterwards. And the same might be true by netilat yadayim as well. So now Gemara says, latuye mai, what does that come to include? Latuya Yerek, vegetables. Vegetables, according to the Tanaim, only require bracha rishona, bore pri adama. They do not require a bracha achrona. Or the Rabbi Yitzchak, dimevarecha Yerek. Rabbi Yitzchak, who introduced the fact that you should say a bracha achrona for Yerek as well, bore nefashot, then latuya mai. Then what does that come to include? Latuya mayo. Again, in the Tanaim, Maya water only requires a bracha rishona, does not require a bracha achrona. According to Rapapa, we also have to make a bracha achrona on mayim, latuye mai. Then what does this come to include? What's the case? We have a bracha rishona, no bracha achrona. Latuye mitzvot, like birkat mitzvot. Make a bracha on your tefillin, you make a bracha on your tzitzit, you make a bracha on lulav. There you have a bracha rishona. You do not have a bracha achrona. So that's an example of that. Now, what's interesting here is that the Gemara is going through a sequence, really, which is something that changed over time, and that has to do with two factors, one of which is the fact that the bracha achrona in the Torah is associated with Eretz Yisrael and with the land itself. The bracha achrona is brought in the parshiyah, v'chalta v'savato v'irachta t'shem lokecha l'haritza tova shenatan lach. That you give the bracha. The bracha is not necessarily for the food. The bracha is for the land that produces the food that you can eat. So the bracha is clearly associated with the land of Israel. So that means that in order to have a bracha achrona, which is what you find in the works of the Tanaim, is that a bracha achrona is either birkat hamazon, or bracha main shalosh, or alamechia aleitz, or alagefen, which are the shivat haminim. Those are the brachot where you find a bracha achrona, because they relate to the Aretz and Eretz Yisrael. The problem was that when there were two different shifts that took place, and those shifts made it that it became that people were going to be making a bracha achrona. One is galut, the fact that the people were kicked out of Eretz Yisrael and they were living in Bavel now. So does that mean that there's no bracha achrona because the bracha's on the land and you're not in the land? That's one issue. The second issue is that when you're moving from an agrarian society to a merchant class to a trading society, then it's possible that you're going to be eating a lot more of items that aren't necessarily vegetables or things that are grown in the ground. You're going to be eating a lot more meat. You're going to be eating a lot more cheese. Other things that are developed where the vegetation is the feedstock for it, but it's not the item itself that you're eating. Given that, it would turn out that you wouldn't be making a bracha achrona very frequently because your major parts of your diet would be shahakol. And number two, you wouldn't be in Eretz Yisrael. So you see here the Amoraim introducing the fact that there is a bracha achrona that exists, even for items that are not associated with the land, and even items that are outside of Eretz Yisrael, and that is this idea, borei nefashot, that in the Tanaic works, borei nefashot is only a bracha rishona. It's not a bracha achrona. It's the Amoraim that introduce it to be a bracha achrona, and that's what you saw here in the sequence that we just did in the Gemara. You see these Amoraim saying, you need a bracha achrona for Yerek, you need a bracha achrona for water, for all these items. And that's coming from this change in society, both the idea that we're not on the land, and number two is that we're moving away from the agrarian society. Those two things precipitate the need for a bracha achrona, whereby many of us can have a whole meal that is just comprised of shahakol items that then would not have a bracha achrona if we're not for the institution of borei nefashot as a bracha achrona. Now, with regards to Birkat HaMitzvot, the Gemara says, in Eretz Yisrael, that they make a bracha when they take off their tefillin. That we keep his principles. Then, what does it come to include? It comes to include bracha over smell. Which, as Rashi says, they don't require a bracha achrona. Rashi says, because hana mu'etet. It's just a small amount of hana. So the bracha rishona is enough for that. The truth is that the easier way to understand it is to say it's birkat ha-shevach. Birkat ha-shevach don't require a bracha achrona. They only require a bracha rishona. Although we do have birkat ha-shevach voda, seemingly that do have a rishona achrona, like suga de zimra, we have baruch shamar in the beginning, ishtabach at the end, halal, where you have a bracha in the beginning, you have a bracha in the end. So that may be what Rashi is after here about mu'etet. When it becomes a much longer bracha shevach, then we require a bracha achron, we require a bracha at the end as well, even for issues of shevach and oda. So that's why by Rechani, you only require a bracha rishona, not a bracha achrona. The Baal Tosafot here brings from the Rabbeinu Tam very important understanding of this idea of making a bracha when you take off the tefillin. Rabbeinu Tam says that you only make a bracha when you take off the tefillin when you're compelled to take off the tefillin because of the halacha. And that is that there is a machloket on the pasuk in Pashat Bo that says, "Shemarta et ha'chuka zot lemoada miyamim yamima." So there, the Gemara argues about the chuka that is mentioned there. Is the chuka a reference to the tefillin? Or is the chuka there a reference to the Pesach or the Korban HaPesach? If you think it's a reference to tefillin, then from there you learn, miyamim yamima, that the din of tefillin or the mitzvah of tefillin only applies during the day and not at night. And that was the view of the Bnei Marava. That was the view of the people in Eretz Yisrael. They used to wear their tefillin all day. And when nightfall came, they took off their tefillin because they believed that the Torah commands you to take off your tefillin. Because it says there that you have to be shamarta tachuka azot lemo adam yamim yamima. That only during the day can you wear tefillin. You may not wear tefillin at night. Since you are compelled to take off your tefillin, you make the bracha of Asher Kedishanu B'mitzvah Mitzvah only Shmor Chukav, which is quoting that pasuk of Shemarta Et HaChukah Zot. You have to be Shomer the Chukah to take off your tefillin at night. And as the Baal Tosafot point out, that in Bavel it was very clear that the Amoraim believe that the mitzvah of tefillin applies at night like it applies during the day, and many of them wore their tefillin during the day and then into the night. The only reason we don't wear tefillin at night is the Gzeret Derbanan. It's not a Din D'Oraita. Those Amoraim believe that the pasuk that we quoted of Shamarta et hachukah zot miyamim lemodah miyamim yamima is a reference to the Korban of Pesach, not to tefillin. Therefore, tefillin is not limited to the daytime only. It can be worn during the day and the night. The reason we don't wear tefillin at night is a gzeirat chachamim, that we're afraid you might fall asleep in them, and then not guard them with the proper kedusha, because you might flatulate while you're wearing the tefillin, which would be inappropriate. And at night, you lose control over certain of the bodily functions, and so it would be inappropriate to have them on when you fall asleep. And that's the gzeira why we don't wear them. Given that, you would not make a bracha when you take off your tefillin at night, because there is a mitzvah to continue wearing them at night. We just don't wear them because of the problems that could arise. And therefore, the Bar Yonatan says, we don't make a bracha when we take off our tefillin at night, as well as the fact that he says that if we don't make a bracha on tzitzit, when we take our tzitzit off as well at night, that's because there's no demand that you take off your tzitzit at night. You might be patur from tzitzit at night, but that doesn't mean you can't keep wearing your tzitzit at night and then just keep them on the next day and do the mitzvah the next day. Because there's no negative precept that says you cannot wear tzitzit at night, just says there's no mitzvah tzitzit at night. So therefore, by tzitzit, you don't have to make a bracha when you take them off, because you're not compelled to take them off. But then the Baal HaTos would ask, what about Shabbat and Yom Tov? When it comes to Shabbat and Yom Tov, we take off our tefillin, because you don't wear tefillin on Shabbat and Yom Tov. And that we agree is true. You don't wear tefillin on Shabbat and Yom Tov. But what the Tosfos point out is that it's not that you can't wear tefillin on Shabbat and Yom Tov. It's just that it is not necessary. And that is because the Gemara says that Mishabai Oat, that which requires an oat, which is regular weekdays require an oat. So you wear the tefillin, which are an oat. But Shabbat and Yom Tov, which they themselves are otot, they don't require the additional oat of tefillin. And so that's why we don't wear tefillin on Shabbat Yom Tov, because it's unnecessary. There's an oath of Shabbat Yom Tov that precludes the necessity to wearing tefillin. But it's not because we're compelled or it's assured to wear the tefillin. It's only because it's unnecessary, or the Torah says, don't wear them because of the fact you already have an oath, but it doesn't say you must take them off or you must not wear them. Given that, you would not make a bracha, even if you took off your tefillin on Erev Shabbat because of Shabbat, or an Erev Yom Tov because of the approaching Yom Tov, because they're really just patur min mitzvah, not chayav to take them off. And that would be similar to what we have by tzitzit, that you're patur at night, but you're not compelled to take them off. Okay, we're going to stop here by the Mishnah on the top of Nun Bet, Amud Aleph.